I want to tell you about a new sponsor here on the program. It's our first sponsor in a while, but in this time of economic uncertainty, this is a great, great business for all of you to partner with. It's Dashing Media Management. New ways of talking to customers are being created left and right, and you need an expert to help guide you through that process. That's where my friend Lex Kramer and Dashing Media Management come in. They're able to help you with social media, blog management, content marketing, graphics, and pretty much all of your marketing needs. They're a one-stop shop. They feature flat rate pricing, transparent reporting, and Lex is just a great person to work with, a good friend of mine, and I hope that you'll support her. So I hope you'll reach out to Lex today at their website, dashingmediamanagement.com. You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Find more great shows like this at wearelibertarians.com.
All right, let's get back to some boring subjects.
Understand the risk to our country.
Freedom brings people together.
You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Learn more at wearelibertarians.com.
Welcome. Welcome to We Are Libertarians. My name is Chris Spangle. We're going to be talking a lot about a lot of things tonight. What a great promo I'm doing here. I'm really succeeding as a host. We're going to talk a little bit about how to think in the internet age of 2020. And man, if you're one of those people that you don't, like, you see faults and merit in both sides of all these different debates and feel like we're all kind of slipping into trutherism, yeah, that's how we feel too. So we're going to talk a little bit about that and talk about thinking errors and just try to get our own bearings here as we talk. We're also going to talk a little bit about Justin Amash entering the race for president. And so we'll cover that right after this.
Warning, this show is for adults, produced by semi-adults. So the language is sometimes strong and offensive.
I don't know what I said.
Welcome to We Are Libertarians, where our goal is to help you sound smarter while talking to your friends. We examine current events from a libertarian perspective while treating modern politics with all of the irreverence it deserves.
There has been lie after lie.
We toss out the screaming heads, put people before political parties, and give context to the news to make you think. Now, here's our host, a 15-year veteran of politics and media, Chris Spangle.
Welcome to the program again. My name is Chris Spangle. It is a pleasure to have you here with us this evening. We've got a new thing called, it's called StreamYard. And so we are able to stream out to all kinds of different, we got Twitch, we got Facebook, we got YouTube. And so you can watch live most Tuesday nights. So just go like our Facebook page. So we will take care of that. I don't know. Yes, we do have a Facebook page. We have a YouTube page. We have a Twitch page. So go check that out. No idea where Harry is. We texted Harry. We were waiting for a while. So hopefully we'll see Harry come along soon. But with me, as usual, is Reinhold. How are you, Reinhold? Well, you're going to have to unmute yourself. We're just killing it today. We probably should have talked to each other, but I was busy doing some work real quick before the beginning of the show, and I don't know what happened to Reinhold. So I guess I'll just continue.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, there we go. You're real quiet,
okay,
though.
There we go, yeah.
Yeah, so turn yourself up.
I had muted for a work thing earlier, and I thought you were hearing me before when we were talking because I was talking about David Bowie.
Nope. You are really, really quiet,
though.
Head.
I thought you were agreeing with me. You were just jamming along.
I was jamming to Space Oddity because that's one of the best songs ever. We can't play it here just because of rules, but go ahead and turn your headphones up if you would. Before we I get so into the show and we jump right into everything, and I forget to do the most important thing, which is to thank our patrons, especially our $100 a month patrons, and that is Anthony Meyer, Craig DaCosta, Ed Brehab, Jason Doolittle, Jeff Bennett, Christy Avery, and Matthew Durbin, as well as Reinhold. You patrons keep the bills paid. Like this little puppy here, this StreamYard that we're using to stream, and we got 52 people watching. That is a lot of money. And thank you to Christy Avery for helping us foot the bill. We really appreciate her generosity as usual. We've got all kinds of people tuning in, asking questions, trying to be a little more interactive. We've got Doug in Atlanta, Ben in North Carolina, Ron in Warsaw, Alex from Sydney, Australia. So very exciting. So, you know, Reinhold, you are incredibly, incredibly
sufferable.
Old is what I was going to say.
Oh, okay.
Turn your mic up more.
All right.
Yeah, so as we are turning into kind of Waldorf and Statler, I think, and the older I get, I'm 36 now, I turn into you and Andy Horning, who is a well-known curmudgeon. Every time I open up my Facebook, and, you know, Harry ended the last live show by saying, get off of social media, it's killing you. And so I've been spending a lot less time on social media since he said that, and he's right. I feel so much more relaxed. Why do you think that it is? I can't put my finger on it. And I think that's part of what irritates me. So I've been spending a lot of time the last week trying to figure out why I'm so irritated by other people's opinions, which I don't necessarily care what other people's opinions are. Like I disagree with people all the time. It's just like, I don't, what is irritating me? You hear me talk a lot. Like, are you irritated when you get on social media through this pandemic?
I'm irritated through social media, but not necessarily just through the pandemic, but the pandemic is highlighting a lot in the areas that we circle in, right? So there are people who are just being contrarian as much as possible, and sometimes that's good, but sometimes it's not when it's done unthinkingly, when it's done, you know, just like snapping at the little nuggets that confirm your bias and ignoring the 99% of the other information out there that doesn't.
Right.
So it's like, why are you like this? Why aren't you looking at this more scientifically, more critical thinkingly? I wonder if critical thinking just needs to be a mandatory class in schools these days. It doesn't seem to be.
Well, that is supposed to be the entire point of school. Yeah, but it's become kind of rote memorization. I think what is bothering me is that, and maybe it's a little bit of fear, because we can no longer have a conversation at all. Like, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and we've lost, 70,000 Americans? We've lost
70,000, yeah.
Yeah, 250, is it worldwide?
It keeps getting, because I remember when the numbers were in the thousands or like hundreds and was reaching that thousand point. I'm just like, wow, that's amazing. And it just hasn't slowed down. And to hear people talk, it's all over. It's slowed down. We've hit the peak. Everything's fine. I'm like, okay, well, so now they have to invent reasons, right? So, no, the numbers are lies. And, you know, they're making them all up and they're trying to scare you. And it's like, I don't think anybody's trying to scare you. I think people are trying to be honest with you and let you make the decisions to make. But it's just weird to see some of the things that have happened in our social circle. Some people have gone on the deep end, in my opinion.
And turn your even more, Reinhold. So Alex, all right. Alex says he's a biochemist working on rapid test kits. So if anybody has questions, put those in the chat, and we'll have him answer those. You know, and Allison, who is a great libertarian, sort of is, and I'm not picking on you, Allison, just sort of highlighting kind of what I'm talking about. So are we ignoring the revised CDC numbers? And this is sort of the thing that I'm talking about, is that if you share an opinion of grief over 70,000 lost Americans in 6-7 weeks, losing about 10,000 people a week at this point, then you're not a real libertarian, and the government is you're okay with government interaction. And then if you talk about government's involvement in this has been uneven, unfair, ineffective, and has made everything worse, then you don't care about those 70,000 Americans. There doesn't seem to be any kind of common conversation about anything anymore. You know, after 9/11, when you had a tragedy, there wasn't this period of like just wanting to tear each other's eyes out. And that's, I think, what's bothering me, is seeing how quickly everybody just shoved themselves into a side and everybody is sitting on one of those two sides, and everybody's just so confused as to what is the truth, because now everybody's got their own version of it, that they just stop paying attention, which sort of gives its own feeling of, like, this is all over. When in reality, the adult grown-up way to think about this, in my view, is that this is a significant biological event, and you can talk about biology without it involving the government, and you should not have the government involved in talking about biology. Like, that's part of the reason that we're all so divided, is that politics is inherently divisive and pits us against each other all the time. And so they're partly to blame for the constant division, because people now need to look at biology through political lenses and have lined up on separate teams. And we're about to enter a period where we really should have been there all along, which is adults need to make decisions for themselves, because the government can say that they put shutdowns on everybody and everybody was stuck in their houses. But, like, in Spain, people were locked in their house for 87 days. Like, if you left, there was a police officer outside. Same with China. This has largely been people kind of doing what they want to do with limited exceptions. You know, my personal behavior, the government has been irrelevant in it. I decided to work from home. My employer wanted me to work from home. I came to work from home. I go to the grocery store once a week. I see a couple close friends or family, and I go out and I get walks. And I wouldn't do anything differently if the government existed or didn't exist, right? And I think that's kind of what most people are doing. You know, the Indiana governor took some crap here in the state because he's been putting in the stay-at-home orders. He goes down to his Brown County home, which apparently, who knew the Indiana governor had a Brown County home? He had a takeout order at one restaurant. He goes in, they ask for a selfie. He takes a selfie. He's this close, you know, with two other people. None of them are wearing masks. He's traveling unnecessarily. He's completely exposed himself as somebody who doesn't really believe in what he's doing, but he's kind of doing what we've all done, which is assessing our own risk level, assessing the risk to our friends and family, and then acting accordingly. And the government can say that it has had some level of effect, but it really, in my mind, I don't know what effect these shutdowns have had other than closing down businesses that don't have lobbyists, you know, other than shutting down and unevenly applying their own rules to everyone, when in reality, everybody should have had their risk assessment. And I just think adults making adult decisions seems like a fair and reasonable thing. But I see the comments. I haven't looked over there. They're blowing up. And I'm sure it's from both sides. You know, I'm trying to kill someone's grandmother, or I'm sucking off the governor of the state of Indiana because I love the government. So it's really kind of crazy. And then instead of going, hey, the government shouldn't have acted this way, and it's been incompetent in these several different ways, people are choosing to just kind of create their own statistics. Or amplifying statistics that fit their bias, that when you watch them, like, did you ever watch, like, the Newt Weiderstein? He's kind of like a German guy who worked at the, I think, the Rockefeller Institute, or I think it was Rockefeller Institute. And he basically said what everybody was saying at the time, which is he was arguing for herd immunity. And they were like, well, wouldn't the hospitals be overrun? And he's like, yeah. Well, wouldn't more people die from the hospitals being overrun? Yeah. And you just think that's okay? It is what it is. I don't... It got shared around, like, look at this genius. Like, he didn't have any information, but it was confirming people's bias. It was picking information that... Or the doctors from California, which dozens and dozens and dozens of doctors now have debunked what those guys have said, and said they've got a skewed sample. Their data isn't factually correct and they're misleading people. And let's be honest, the right will grab onto anybody that wants to give an alternative opinion. And they were on Fox News by the end of the week, which, as small business owners who are sharing an independent, like, Don't you think that might have been part of their goal? Like, they have this press conference knowing that they're going to go viral and then end up on Fox News and line their own pockets. Like, why are they more credible than the doctors that, you know, we're claiming are charging, $39,000 per COVID patient, and all doctors are corrupt except these two doctors that are telling me what I want to hear. So I think people are, Ryan Holder, just kind of confused. Like, let's start kind of parsing some of this together, and why have we separated ourselves into two camps?
Well, I mean, that's what happens really when you get politics involved into anything. Politics becomes, since we are dealing with this stuff and not having a non-governmental agency be the one to be out in front of this and leading this response or the information release that's coming through the government, it's up for grabs because now we've got a politics in place, right? So that's where your problem comes in. And anytime you enter politics into something, people do this. They just kind of lose their bearings because politics in America, and it's not just from Trump. This was going on before, but it's become a blood sport where it's me against my enemy, and I will do anything I can to defeat that enemy. And everybody in between, get out of the way because you're just preventing me from winning. So people grab onto any information that they can get. And I think a lot of times libertarians, because we don't trust the government, we don't, you know, like authoritarianism, we don't like the government telling people what to do, they start just questioning everything that the government says. So if the government says something, it's obviously wrong. They're obviously lying to us, or they're obviously trying to make us do this. That's why there's such an embrace of a lot of conspiracy theories in the Libertarian Party. Because they, in their bones, feel like they're being lied to by government in order to keep everybody locked down. That's the only explanation in their head of why the population is willing to put up with losing our rights, you know, little by little every year. It's not human nature. It's got to be a nefarious action by the people in power in order to do that. And the government's done some horrible, rotten things in the past. But it doesn't mean that everything that they're doing is of that vein. Yeah. A lot of that has been more incompetence, not planned control over your lives.
Right. So I was reading this book by Eric Fromm called On Obedience. And it's a very insightful book. And it talks about rational obedience and irrational obedience. And you know, I think why the polls are 93% for government action, shutting places down, all that, it feels like rational obedience, right? Like I said, I would be sheltering in place voluntarily. The government has been irrelevant in my decision-making in any case. Like, I haven't been affected by the government. I haven't gotten my stimulus check, so I definitely haven't been positively impacted. And so I think people look at that and they go, okay, this is rational obedience, and I don't understand why people are protesting. And those people never look at the protesters and go, they see this as irrational obedience, which, you know, I think most Americans would look at civil asset forfeiture if they knew about it and would go, that's irrational obedience. You're just going to come take my stuff with no due process, no trial. Even if I get a trial and I'm acquitted, I don't get my stuff back. That's irrational obedience. You're forcing me to be obedient to the state. And so the reality is that when things shut down, like restaurants shut down, the governments are going to open those places. You know why? Property taxes, sales taxes, income taxes, payroll taxes. We run around talking about taxation as theft and that they're a parasite on the economics of the nation. That still holds true, right? They're still going to want us to go back to work and go out. The entire system is predicated on more credit, more spending, more consumerism. Get out there and shop. So do you think that governors who have, here in Indiana, we've seen a $1 billion windfall. Do you think those people really want to see a $1 billion windfall from their taxes and cut services in an election year? No. The restaurants, they're all going to open up, right? So to me, it has never seemed like the place to start in terms of messaging. The place to start is centralizing the control of testing at the CDC and the FDA and the incompetence that happened there. That is a provable piece of information that most people will look at and go, okay, I believe the government is incompetent and you are confirming my bias. You are saying something that I believe. And it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat, a Republican, libertarian, anarchist, independent. Most people are biased against the government. And so if you point out very rational things, then it's easier for them to accept than to try to get them to sell them something that isn't, it doesn't fit their bias. They think you are crazy when you do that, you know? So part of this is not only how we think about it, but also how we message this stuff. And that's kind of what frustrates me, is that we're messaging the wrong stuff, and you can decrease people's trust in the state when you go, they centralized testing to a single point of failure, and they didn't, they have a monopoly on intelligence gathering. Well, Donald Trump failed on intelligence gathering. The federal government failed on testing, and now they have this blanket shutdown. It's been unevenly applied. The people who have lobbyists get to stay open. The people who don't have lobbyists have to close down. Epidemiologically, there is no difference between a liquor store and a florist. There's no reason for the florist to be closed if they want to be closed or opened. A liquor store is the same size of a florist, has the same amount of traffic. It's just that the liquor store has a better lobbyist. Well, that works with that. People grab onto that. They understand that. So it's, you know, I saw something this week that the CDC magically disappeared half the deaths. Did you see that?
Yeah, I saw that. That's what was I was going to bring up. That was brought up in the chat there. That was the revised CDC numbers, which weren't revised CDC numbers, by the way.
No, what was happening is there is the front-facing CDC website that Johns Hopkins is pulling, and that is 70,000 deaths. And then there's the back-end number with half of that amount, and those are like finalized numbers. And so they go through, they check all of that information, certify that this is the actual number, and they report that. So that slow reporting to Dinesh D'Souza was a clear conspiracy that got shared thousands of times and amplified across because it confirmed the bias of people who wanted that to be true. And so people were using fake information because they didn't fully understand the information. And the first person that put that out there, that puts that into social media, they may not understand the information. It's hard to pay attention to all this stuff. But, you know, it wasn't hard to go and check it. And they have 18 disclaimers on the website. But
what was funny is I saw people sharing the statement from the CDC and the memes, and it includes the asterisk at the end of it.
Right.
Did you go look and see what the asterisk meant, said?
What
did you go down
say?
And read it? It says these numbers may be 8 weeks old.
Right. Right.
So
right.
There's a lag in the reporting. So these aren't the current numbers. These are official old numbers. But
so,
people believe, you know, it confirmed their bias that they were being lied to by the government, which is the CDC. If the CDC had been a non-governmental agency that had been operating for years as a scientific community that could be looked to and trusted because they weren't, you know, they had earned trust over that period of time, a lot of this would go away because people would then feel more like trusting an entity like that. Like the, you know, I use Underwriters Laboratories a lot in this example. It's not a government agency. It's completely separate. And people trust it because they've earned that trust over decades.
Right.
If we had an organization like that was running the CDC or the FDA or education, then we could go to these people and get information from them, get guidance for them, and it's not going to be motivated by politics and whoever's controlling that message. But when you've got all this stuff rolled up into the government, that all becomes part of the message. It all becomes part of the politics of it.
Yeah, these large institutions have no credibility for reasons. I mean, and when somebody loses credibility, for instance, like the FDA or the CDC, in a private enterprise system, in a market system, when you lose credibility, you lose market share and you eventually die. And so it is important for you to maintain your credibility because there are consequences to not maintaining your credibility. And so in Underwriters Laboratory, Consumer Reports, Johns Hopkins, these they have a duty to maintain their credibility or else they don't stay in business. Their survival depends on it. Whereas in a government system, it doesn't really matter who messes up or doesn't mess up at the CDC, they're probably not going to get fired. It doesn't matter if Dr. Fauci, now Dr. Fauci feels a, it is incumbent on Dr. Fauci feeling a personal sense of responsibility towards his job to maintain his credibility so that people will listen to him. But if he doesn't, I mean, Donald Trump is the best example of this. It does. Donald Trump doesn't think about his credibility for most Americans. He wants to maintain his credibility for the people that support him. And, you know, that has been a growing feature of American politics and in the presidency for a long time. He's not the first one to do it. But when most Americans don't trust their president, they see their actions as largely illegitimate. Well, what are we going to do about it? Are there real consequences other than elections? Well, they've rigged a lot of the election laws, so there aren't a lot of consequences for public officials or bureaucrats. The ability to face force consequences on government agencies is much lessened. So they don't have as much of a responsibility to be responsible actors. You know, there are oversight committees and being drugged into the public square, but
work anymore.
It doesn't work anymore. Impeachment isn't going to change Donald Trump's behavior. You know, like the amount
He stands up and says, I'm the president and none of this is illegal because what Nixon said, and when Nixon said it, everybody freaked out.
Right.
Trump says it and he gets a bump in his polls.
Yeah. And so as we kind of give more and more to the government, we are slowly driven more and more crazy because it divides us into only two parties and two camps, and now everything is political. And so as independent thinkers, as independent people, I want to cover some cognitive bias. We've talked about the confirmation bias, which is where you basically seek out information. You pay more attention to information that reinforces previously held beliefs and ignore evidence to the contrary. I think we see that on a constant basis. But I think there are a few more, and this is from, I'll put this in the show notes, the thing cut off, I think it's the Minnesota, University of Minnesota. There's anchoring bias, which is an over-reliance on the first piece of information obtained and using it as the baseline for comparison. Now, this happened on a lot of the modeling side, right? Like the closers, we'll call them openers and closers. We'll participate in the false binary of this. And so that first Imperial College model, which said the worst case scenario, 2 million people would die, that's an anchoring bias. So people grab onto that and they say, this is the model. This is the IMHS model, the Oregon, the Washington model, University of Washington model. This, I'm going to hold on to this. And there are a lot of people going, no, we've got to stay closed. We've got to shut down until we get a vaccine. What? There's never been a coronavirus vaccine, and there isn't one coming. And the virus that is ravaging America, it has morphed from the virus that was ravaging China. And it will continue to morph. The one that will hit us in the fall will probably be different, thanks to antigen shift, than the one that we faced in the springtime. And so if there is a vaccine, it's going to be like the flu vaccine that you have to get every single year. And so we have to be adaptable and flexible, and we can't sit here and think that we're going to close down entire parts of the economy for 2 years on the hope that we get a vaccine. The hope strategy doesn't work. If you're one of those people, I'm sorry, you're going to have to let go of that anchoring bias, and you're going to have to be more flexible, and we're going to have to be able to look at new data and go, hey, things aren't as bad as we thought they were going to be two months ago. Because they aren't. They aren't. And there's people going, only people over 60 are dying. Well, yeah, we knew that. Reinhold, did you know that? Did you know that the death rate in people over 60 was much, much, much higher than it was for you and me? Because I knew that.
Well, for you, because I'm reaching that age, so there's a gradient there, I'm sure. But no, we knew that it was hitting people with conditions and elderly people harder. I mean, that's why my parents have been sheltering in house and they haven't left the house for 2 months, and we don't go over and visit because I don't want to take a chance on giving them anything, because I know my parents wouldn't survive it. They both have very issues that are very bad for this. So,
right.
I mean, this is information that was relatively known early on, but people are acting like now that on the opener side of things that. If you're under 50, you're not going to die, so don't worry about
there's
it.
There's no risk if you're under 50.
But they don't mention the other things, like you'll survive it, but there's permanent damage to the lungs, there's permanent damage to the kidneys happening, there's permanent damage to the heart happening from this virus, depending on how bad it hits you.
Right.
And the strain that's going out now, since it's mutated, is actually worse than the strain that first started to hit. So things are going to be interesting for the next couple of months, and the fact that we're opening back up again, the good thing about that is people took the time during the closing to adjust their businesses, to adjust how they operate. So there's people really more cognizant of social distancing. If you go to a store, they've got plexiglass up now, and they try to keep, you know, face spit from getting onto each other.
Yeah. Which is what the masks,
we didn't care before.
Right, which is what the masks are about. I mean, let's be honest. The masks are not going to stop the virus from penetrating your mask. If you are a person that believes that if I wear this mask, it will keep me from getting the virus, don't have false confidence, because it can't. It is, you know, an antiviral N95 mask maybe, but somebody put up a chart, basically it's like peeing your pants. If you have no pants on and you pee, you're going to spray your droplets everywhere. But if you have pants on and you pee your pants, it's going to stop it. It's only going to hit you. And that's kind of what this is about. That's what the mask thing is about. Now, the Surgeon General still is out there saying the mask, don't get fooled. Like, you can still get it if you have the mask on. It's not foolproof. And make sure that you have it covered all the time, because if you don't, it's not going to be effective. Like ineffective mask wearing, where you have, you know, just down here, or you're just covering your mouth, like that's no good. You know, I personally look at this and go, I just want an antibody test to see if I had it or not. If I haven't had it, then I'm going to probably wear a mask. If I have had it, then I'm not going to wear a mask because I'm immune to it. You know what I mean? So,
but we think so, yeah. But the other thing too is about that is that, if we had testing 2 months ago, we could have gotten past that point and opened up with a lot more confidence. Now we're opening up these businesses and people are still scared because they don't know. It's a fear of the unknown that they're going through right now. So without that information, they're going to be treating it more fearful than they would have. I think the economy would have taken off, would have, because they're trying to do like a V-shaped recovery. And I don't think it's going to be like that. I think it's going to be much more of a slow uptick. But I think it would have been better if we had had testing out there just so that people could have confidence one way or the other in knowing what their situation is.
Yeah. And that's again, that goes back to the failure of testing. That goes back to the 6 weeks, the lost month by the New York Times that we talked about repeatedly, where that is an example of government failure that caused more shutdowns, more jobs to be lost, more people to die. That's a direct result of government incompetence and overreach that we can talk about. That is, I think look into the mask. Mask wearing should not be mandatory. Nothing should be, it should all be voluntary based on your information. I think you touched on the fear of unknown, and that is a huge part of it. But, you know, when we talk about the elderly dying, that's the hindsight bias, right? So people are looking back now, 7 weeks, and saying we shouldn't have done X because now we know why. And that's not how life works, you know? And so for our opener friends on the right, you can't sit here and judge the decisions. Like the people have been hitting me going, well, you thought this was real and now it's clearly not real. I'm like, 70,000 Americans dead in 7 weeks isn't real. Like that's a brand new disease that just killed 70,000 Americans that, like, my mom has been in an ICU working. I know that it's real. Like, and I know that it is much different than the flu. I know that the spread rate is like, the argument always was, we need to all voluntarily, like, my argument was always we need to voluntarily shelter in place. But the argument from people who didn't think that this was a hoax 8 weeks ago always was we need to shelter in place to slow the spread. I now don't know that we necessarily slowed the spread. I think that people did whatever they damn well pleased. And I don't think that we necessarily, I think so many businesses were open that this was not a quarantine and this was not martial law. Like, this half measure didn't do anything other than hurt the economy in my estimation, but it's hard to prove that.
I don't think the closing did as much, but I think the information of what was going on did. I think there was, so if you look at some data from Open Table, when they do reservations for restaurants, the restaurant business was tanking. They had 70% drop in business weeks before the first shutdown.
Sure.
Because people were scared to go and possibly get this virus that they've been hearing about, right? So I think people were starting to kind of cut back on a lot of things in the economy-wise. And I also think, on top of that, that there were problems in the economy that a lot of people were looking for this as an excuse to remedy on their businesses. Like, they had overextended in their business, they were doing too much. Now is a time that they can let some people go and have cover for it, you know, and contract their business a little bit and change. But I also think it's providing new opportunities for businesses as well.
Right.
But we're seeing people voluntarily sheltering in place. Like 70% of the people were okay with the shutdowns or approved of them because they thought that this was necessary. So those people are obviously going to be following those rules. It was the other 20% probably that didn't, right? So, but they were going out. They still weren't going out and going crazy. And as long as there's some so we have fewer people driving on the roads. We have fewer people getting in accidents. We're seeing some benefits from all this. I mean, not only are we not passing around the coronavirus as much as could have happened, we're also not passing around flus and other types of illnesses that are communicable. We're actually stopping those a little bit too. So I think people are starting, I think people realize that there are changes need to be made because of this and the realization of it. And we're going to see them continue those behaviors well into the next year, probably. I don't think those plexiglass plates are coming down anytime soon at the Meijer.
But those are symbols of fear, Reinhold.
Is it fear or is it just precaution?
Fear.
What was it that somebody said that wearing a mask is a sign of oppression?
That was Jeffrey Tucker, who has lost his mind through all this and his credibility there are some libertarian thinkers that I'm not going to look at it the same way after a lot of this, but yeah, like the mask is a symbol of obedience, like not for nothing, but nobody really necessarily knows what's going on, which we'll talk about in a moment. I've got a couple videos teed up, but like, you know, my advice is like, a mask to me isn't going to do a lot, but there are people who want to wear a mask, you know, and they should, you know, and if a mask is what it's going to take for a business to open, then I don't care. Like, it's just one of those things where you're just like, wear the mask, don't wear the fucking mask. I don't care anymore. Like, just shut up.
One thing I wanted to bring up too, before we go on too far. I was looking into the 1918 flu, and I know you've done a lot of investigation into that too. And I did a special look just to see if there were any conspiracy theories at the time for the flu.
Right.
And guess what? We're Americans. They were there.
tell the story. And do you remember the story about the San Francisco mask riot?
I don't know this. I don't know the San Francisco mask riot. I know about the German U-boat that supposedly released the virus as a gas. And some old woman supposedly saw it. And that's how it affected everybody. It was because it was in.
So this, I don't know if you dropped off or your internet froze. Or my internet froze, maybe. Let's see. Well, that doesn't look good. Did I freeze or did you freeze?
Well, to me, you froze, but I could have froze to you.
Who knows?
It could have been the other way.
All right. As long as we're back, because I'm trying to load this and it's not coming on. There was actually a mask riot. And, you know, and this is sort of the million-dollar question. Jackie has been a longtime libertarian. What do libertarians want to accomplish by not wearing a mask? I think for me, it's more, I'm looking at it as a rational, like, it's, I'm looking at it from a scientific point of view, and I think, but the obedience people like Jeffrey Tucker, I'm just like, nah, man, I'm not on board with that.
There are libertarians who are like, if you tell them what, if you say, hey, you should do this, they'll go, no, I'm going to do the exact opposite.
Right. Contrarian for contrarian's sake.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the bandwagon effect. It's like, if you saw a libertarian out wearing a mask, you know, the bandwagon effect is a different bias. A person is more likely to go along with a belief if there are many others who hold that belief. Other names for this are herd mentality or groupthink. Surely independent thinkers like us, and hey, we do it too. I do it too. I remember I was at the National Libertarian Convention, and I was there as media, and the LibSoc candidate for chair yelled out, rent is theft, and everybody started booing, and I started booing, and then I was like, what am I doing? Like, it happens, you know? So, but yeah, the bandwagon effect, I think, on both sides is taking place, where you're trying to virtue signal to your side that, you know, I'm the most cautious with the disease. I'm the most libertarian, you know, and it, people just kind of build on it and try to outdo each other. And then you just like have to step back and go, man, whew, this got a little out of control. Well, all right. I don't know what's, if it's my internet or yours.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, I can hear you. So, okay. But you were giving me the mask story, weren't you?
Yeah, so I was trying to find it. So T. Greer, Scholars_stage on Twitter, tweeted this out March 23rd. So get this. In the Spanish flu, San Francisco authorities mandated all people wear masks in public. Police arrested citizens who wouldn't wear them. For a whole month, this pretty much worked. But then, the first wave of the pandemic passed. People were sick of having their lives constrained. There were lots of people getting sick anyways and writing letters to the editor about how useless the masks were. In November, cops arrested. November would have been about 3 months after the beginning of the first wave. In November, cops arrested 400 no-mask wearers in a sting operation against the city's hotels, but the public support had burst. Shops ordered their clerks to stop wearing the things, and citizens of San Francisco organized, I kid you not, an anti-mask league of San Francisco. The league successfully got the San Francisco City Council to repeal the ordinance in December for a good 3 weeks until it was put back in place around Christmas. By that point, the entire city was civilly disobeying the mask order and continued to put on in their disobedience until February, when the law could be repealed again as the pandemic was officially past its worst. What I gained from this story, Americans, a people who have been refusing to wear masks in epidemics for more than a century. Source was an American pandemic, pages 180 to 182. So that was way back in March 23rd, and he predicted the future, Reinhold.
Oh, yeah. It's you predict human nature, and you're sure to get some of those right. So I know one of the hardest places hit in the United States was Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that was because they were having a big rally to buy bonds, Liberty bonds, for the war effort. So it was called a Liberty Parade. And at the time, the people were saying, the medical people were trying to go to the government and saying, please don't have this parade. It's going to be a problem. This virus is going around. It's going to hurt people. And they put that aside and said, no, we need to have this this fundraiser, basically, for the government for the war effort. So they went ahead and had the Liberty Parade. And within a week after, it was just all through Philadelphia. And yeah. it was
Philadelphia
the,
got
the thing of. Yeah, the thing about that flu was that it was so fast acting. I mean, there were people who were getting it and dead in 12 hours.
Yeah.
This one's like the complete opposite, where it just takes so long before you even know you have it that you're going around infecting people. But there it was just, you couldn't stop it. You were just getting, it was so quick.
Yeah, in that pandemic in Philadelphia, it got so bad that it completely eviscerated the trust in the government because of that action. And so the mayor lost so much credibility that it was basically anarchy. And the city fathers had to step in and organized a private response to the pandemic and use their money to basically set up field hospitals, because the Philadelphia city government completely collapsed. not first in credibility and then just inability because nobody was willing to trust them at all. I want to talk a little, then there's the in-group bias. People tend to divide themselves into groups and then attribute positive attributes to their own group while putting down the out-group, essentially. There's also this group, the ostrich effect bias, avoiding bad news about a decision by ignoring data that might be negative. Now, that is everybody who's not on the opener or closer side. They're not even paying attention to the news because they have just given up completely on all this. So I want to play a couple videos, and I can do a screen share so you all can see the video too with this newfangled technology. And these are going to be a little bit longer. I'm not clipping these out. This is not a talk radio show, so we have some space here to talk about things. And the first one's going to be the longest, but I want to talk. I could take this information and I could share it with you. But I think it's going to have more impact coming from neuroscientists and doctors and, you know, people who give TED Talks and not me. So this first one is, and let me see if I can switch over my screen here. Excuse me. This is trippy. So the first one is Why Do We Believe Things That Aren't True by Philip Fernbach. This was a TED Talk in Denver. Given in 2017. And so I'm starting it a little bit late, and he's talking about flat earthers.
BOB and the flat earthers really believe that the earth is flat, despite all evidence to the contrary. So, why am I showing you this? Because your natural reaction to this story is wrong. Your first instinct is to laugh at the flat earthers and assume they must be incredibly dense or crazy. But actually, they're not all that different than you and I. As human beings, false belief is our birthright. It stems from fundamental principles that govern the way our minds work and the way we store knowledge. Consider how common it is for groups of people to believe things that just aren't true. Right now, in this moment, it feels like we're in the midst of an epidemic. The explosion of fake news shows how easy it is to dupe people on the left and the right. And science denial has gone mainstream. Significant proportions of the population maintain beliefs counter to the scientific consensus on critical issues like vaccination, global warming, and the safety of genetically modified foods. Public attitudes about these issues literally determine whether we can feed ourselves, whether we can raise healthy children, and whether we can forestall a climate disaster. The stakes could not be higher. Which is why it's just not good enough to chalk all this up to lunacy or stupidity. Simplistic explanations like that aren't getting us anywhere. If we really want to improve the way we grapple with these challenges, we have to go deeper. We have to understand what it is about the way we think that makes us so susceptible to believing things that aren't true. And that explanation actually begins with a kind of shocking observation. As individuals, we do not know enough to justify almost anything we believe. Now, I know that might sound crazy to you, but let's think about a couple really obvious facts. We all believe that the Earth revolves around the sun. Of course we do. It's the most basic fact in the world. But on what basis? Can you explain the astronomical observations that support that belief? I know I can. What about smoking? We all know it's terrible for us, right? But what's actually in cigarette smoke that's bad? And what does it do to our bodies and our cells? What's cancer really? How does it even form? These are not isolated examples. Most of what we believe is not based on what's in our heads. And there's a good reason for that. There's not much in our heads. As human beings, we are just not made to store a lot of detailed information. In the 1980s, a psychologist named Thomas Landauer set out to estimate the size of an individual's knowledge base in bytes, the same scale that's used to measure computer memories. One approach he took was to analyze the result of memory experiments, where people are asked to study some pictures or words or bits of music, and then later tested to see if they recognize them. Using the data, he was able to estimate the rate at which we can acquire knowledge and also the rate at which we forget what we learn. And then he extrapolated to a 70-year lifespan. So, how much do you know? Landauer's estimate? 1 gigabyte. I think this is an amazing result. Mind-blowing, really. 1 gigabyte is a tiny amount. By comparison, you can buy a thumb drive on Amazon.com for less than 18 bucks that holds 64 gigabytes. Now, at this point, some of you guys might be freaking out a little bit, feeling a little bit concerned. After all, we all think it's the most important thing in the world to know a lot and have great memories. But really, this is a misconception. We do not have to know a lot because we're not made to think on our own. It's natural to think about thinking as what happens between your ears, but that's not where the magic really happens. This video comes from a psychologist by the name of Michael Tomasello and his colleagues. They study human children's cognitive abilities in comparison to other animals like chimpanzees. The goal is to understand what really makes us special. What abilities do we excel at that other animals just cannot master? You see how easily this young child reads the mind of the experimenter and then figures out how to coordinate his behavior to achieve the goal. He even makes eye contact at the end, as if to say, I've got your back, man. This is so natural to us that it seems like nothing, but it's actually incredibly difficult to design a cognitive system that's capable of collaboration. This is really the secret to our success. It's what separates us from all other thinking creatures. Chimpanzees routinely fail at tasks that require sharing knowledge and working together to pursue goals, tasks that young children master with ease. Now, for me, this realization was a major wake-up call. It really changed my perspective on the nature of the mind. I'm a cognitive scientist. I'm used to studying how individuals make decisions or solve problems in isolation. But thinking is a social process. Rather than happening inside your head, it emerges from your interactions with those around you. People are a little more like bees than we often realize. In a beehive, you have an incredibly complex cluster of behaviors that is achieved despite no individual being responsible for it all. Food is collected and stored, the hive is protected from intruders, genetic diversity is introduced. The key is specialization. Each individual does its own little part, and the complexity emerges. The same is true of people. On our own, none of us knows all that much. We don't have to. We each have our own little slice of expertise, and our minds are built to collaborate and to share knowledge, which allows us to pursue incredibly complex goals when none of us has anything approaching the knowledge to understand it all. This is the Milan Cathedral. It's one of humanity's great works. Construction began in 1386, and the facade was completed, get this, under Napoleon in the 1800s. It turns out that cathedrals have a punch list, like a home renovation. The punch list was completed when they consecrated the final gate in the 1960s. 600 years. In that time, there were 75 chief engineers responsible for the project and thousands upon thousands of people involved. None of those people had anything remotely approaching the knowledge to understand it all, not even close. Everything great we do as human beings depends on this ability to share knowledge and to collaborate. So that's the positive side of the knowledge sharing story. When we put our minds together, we can do incredible things. But there's also a dark side. Because we are built to so seamlessly draw on knowledge outside of our heads, we often fail to realize the limits of our own understanding. Let me tell you about a study that my colleague Stephen Sloman recently ran. He told his study participants about some new scientific discoveries that he completely made up. For instance, a kind of glowing rock. He told one group of people that scientists had not yet explained why the rocks glow. And then he asked them, how well do you understand? Unsurprisingly, they said they had no clue. This makes perfect sense. They knew nothing about the rocks. The more surprising result is what happened when he told a different group of people about the same discovery, but this time he told them that scientists had explained exactly how the rocks worked. Now, the participants claimed to understand the rocks a little bit better themselves, which is kind of weird because just like the other group, they knew nothing about the rocks. It was as if the scientists' knowledge had been directly transmitted to them, even though it was never described. And it turns out that a similar thing happens when you surf the internet. Just having access to all of that information makes you feel like you know a lot more than you do. The sense of understanding is contagious. And when contagious understanding is paired with individual ignorance, it can be a toxic recipe. The danger is that I may express a strong belief because I feel like I understand. But my sense of understanding is false. It comes from those around me expressing strong beliefs because they feel like they understand. But their sense of understanding comes from those around them, and so on. Individually, none of us knows enough to tell what's true and what's false. And yet, because we feel like we're on firm ground, we don't do enough to verify. And that is how entire groups of people can come to believe things that aren't true. We can build cathedrals, but we can also build houses of cards.
So, Dennis, this concept of collective knowledge is, I think, an interesting one, that we're highly persuadable. We're all a product of what we read, the conversations that we have, the environment that we grew up in, and the concept of social learning is one that I don't think is talked often enough and helps contribute to a lot of the problems that we're having now, in that belief is easy. It's easy to believe things. It's easy to see a piece of information and go, that is something that I agree with. I'm going to believe that. Skepticism is harder, where you start to question beliefs. It's harder to stand up and say, I don't believe this, because then the people around you are going to go, you're a fucking idiot. You know, that's a harder thing. And so as we begin to, when we're in the middle of something that is highly scientific, we look at experts and we go, they're all wrong or they're all right. We have to understand that they're also a product of their environment, and that we should keep an open mind and make sure that we verify a lot of this information, understanding that, you know, we don't just believe the first thing that you read. Don't believe the first thing that you see. Just because you feel it, it doesn't mean that it's necessarily true. You have to work through and be skeptical about the information that you're taking in, even if it's from trusted sources. This becomes even more imperative if you only read or listen to one or two sources. You know, Alex Jones has a very dark and scary worldview. And if you only take information in from Alex Jones and the people affiliated with Alex Jones, and they're the only ones you trust, they're going to lead you to very dark places. And so when you find information that may conflict with theirs, it doesn't mean that it's don't inflexibly say that it's wrong. Try to investigate why they disagree with information that you may believe in.
Right. And there's even another part of that, that where you think you're being skeptical and you're actually more embracing of your own echo chamber than you are the people you're telling aren't being skeptical. You know what I mean? Like, I see that a lot with the people who really like conspiracy theories, is that they will mock anybody who gives any information or has any opinion other than what they know is to be the truth, while telling you that they're the ones that are the holders of the real knowledge. And it's like, you know, they're embracing their own echo chamber and doing exactly what they're accusing you of doing, while they're, you know, not even recognizing any of themselves. And it's one of the things I did when I was writing for Watchblog, is that I was constantly putting my information up against people who thought different, had a different worldview than me. On the blog, there were libertarians in the middle, but there were Republicans and Democrats both writing for that site, all on the same page. And we would constantly talk against each other. So I knew that I had to question my beliefs and make sure that I was coming with, you know, as solid as a base that I had, because it was going to get shredded if I didn't.
Yeah.
So I got into this habit of always questioning what I'm thinking. And I think it's a good practice for people to do. It's not easy, and it's not something that a lot of people are going to do, but I think it's a healthy thing to do.
Yeah. I just did a podcast the other day with my good friend Dion Curry. He is not talking about me in this. He was talking about the last video. But, you know, Dion and I, over the last year, and Miss Pat, have been doing the Pat Down podcast, which you should listen to. It's a very funny show. And, you know, we talked a little bit about, in an episode that'll air soon, about the conversations that we've had. And, you know, growing up in a white community with no black people around at all, it was... you know, it's been an education being around Miss Pat, and then being in the Facebook group with a lot of black people and learning things that I just didn't know. And there are things that when you are living in an all white community, growing up in an all white community, you don't have to think about certain things because you just don't need to. It's just not, I don't have to think about the things that Dion has to think about, for instance. You know, there was a young man in Georgia running and there's no other word for it than essentially lynched. I mean, he was shot to death because he was black in the wrong neighborhood. You know, and I probably 2 years ago, 5 years ago, would have seen that and just kept moving. It doesn't concern me. But then you have to start to think about why is that impulse there for this person just to assume that because this person is running through a neighborhood and he's black, he must be the guy robbing houses. And even if the person was robbing houses, why is that worth the death penalty from this guy and his son? You know, like it's a complete miscarriage of justice. And then on top of it, the guy didn't get charged with anything because he's saying that it was in self or not self defense. It wasn't the Zimmerman defense. It was that it was a citizen's arrest gone wrong. And so they didn't charge him. You're telling me that if the black guy had said that the police would go, "Oh, all right, well, we won't charge you then. We'll wait until we get a grand jury organized." No, that's not how.
So if I want to kill somebody, I can just say that I was arresting them and it went bad and I can get away with it.
It's apparently right. It's a bullshit defense. You know, but as a white person living in an all-white community in my entire life, I didn't have to be confronted with any of these kinds of conversations or these kinds of facts or any of this. And it's important for me to have diversity in my life to understand what other people are saying and what other people's experiences are. When Harry on this show about 3 years ago told me that every time he gets into the car, he doesn't know if he's coming home, that blew my mind because I never have that thought. When my friend Hannah said, when I get up, I sometimes hold off on going to the bathroom and I sit uncomfortably because when I get up to walk to the bathroom, I know my coworkers are leering at me and it makes me feel gross. And I went, I never have to think about that. You know, so there are different experiences in different lives. And that's why just talking to a bunch of different people, reading is the most important thing. Like reading a bunch of different stuff and trying to break out of your own echo chamber is so important. We've started sharing a book a day, a book recommendation every single day on all We Are Libertarians platforms. I'm going to make a Goodreads list that I'll put, you know, in the show notes at some point. This is a big, what I liked about that guy's clip is that this is a big, complex society. And it is impossible for you to know everything. It is impossible for me to know everything. Although I come close, Reinhold. It's just, we have to outsource pieces of knowledge in our society. And so one of the things that I absolutely hate is anti-intellectualism and people pushing you to not believe experts. Don't trust the experts. They're lying to you. Don't read these media outlets. If you don't trust the New York Times, you should read the New York Times every single day, because it will make you a better thinker by reading things you don't agree with and then arguing against it. You will read something you don't agree with, get pissed off at it, and that's when you start to figure out what you believe, because you go to figure out why you're pissed off. So, you know, it is important for you to push yourself out of that comfort zone, out of that bias, that echo chamber, and start to challenge yourself a little bit intellectually. And that's how we're going to start to figure things out in a better way. Yeah, some modeling was wrong and some experts were wrong, but I'm sorry, I'm going to trust an epidemiologist or the several hundred epidemiologists that are all on the same page over an economist who has a contrarian opinion all the time about everything. The guy like Gerald Celente that's been telling me we're all going to end and it's going to be famine and blood in the streets and the dollar's crashing at any minute and just buy gold. By the way, I have a gold sponsor and it's all coming to an end. Like Gerald Celente or whatever his name is was saying the same thing in 2008. And as a young, persuadable person, like I was sure that in any moment the markets were going to completely obliterate, the dollar would be worthless, I'd be homeless, I'd be out of a job. Because I was like, I'm a new libertarian, I need to just believe what libertarians believe to be a good libertarian. Well, that person led me towards some really bad thinking that wasn't true because that person wanted me to buy their books. So that's a person that I don't necessarily trust when this, yeah, the economy is not good right now. But is it Gerald Celente bad? I don't think so. So, you know, just because they believe somewhat of what you believe, it doesn't mean that you have to believe them for everything. Don't outsource your thinking to other people.
Question what you read, but also don't just dismiss it either. I mean, because there's a difference between questioning something and dismissal of something, right? Dismissal is unthinking. So always be thinking about that, or try to find people that who have been proven to be right more in the past than, you know, other people who may be saying something differently. Most scientists have been proven that they're right about a lot of things for a long time. To suddenly just think that they're all going to be something different, I just don't. I don't see it. I mean, yeah, there are people out there. There are some out there who are just wrong. There are some out there who do terrible things, but they've most likely been doing them for a while. So try to find out those good sources. But
it's going to look out for the good.
You know, So when I see stuff like that, I go out and look and say, okay. Whenever I hear so what I used to do is I would hear a story from somebody, social media or on a website before social media, and I would say, okay, that sounds interesting, but let me check this out. So I would go look to the other side. I would go to like Real Clear Politics is a great example. I'd go to Real Clear Politics, and for every time there was a big issue that was going on, there would be someone from the left who's written this article, and then someone from the right who's written about the same subject right next to it. And you could look at it and go, okay, what are they saying and what are the other people saying? And a lot of times you'll find the truth somewhere in that conversation between the two. When you look at what one person says and the other person says, no, that's not right because of this, and this is the reality because of that, and then they may respond back with, oh, but this, that's when you start seeing where the truth really probably lies, somewhere in the middle between both of them.
Right.
And you can really get a good sense of what you should be believing at that point.
So a couple of things in the chat here, you know, Dion says it does affect you. You can keep on moving, but it does affect you because to the people who have legitimate beefs about, for instance, racial justice, they put you in the category of being complicit with the system because you're not willing to make yourself uncomfortable and have discussions that you don't fully understand, you know, and you know, Tim kind of responded, being complicit is allowing someone to label you and then you're one of them and then they marginalize you. And the reality is to not be marginalized is to get into the discussion, to get into understanding, to get into listening, to get into talking and trying to seek out people. I don't know a lot about this thing that I'm curious about, but I'm too afraid. To stop being afraid. Fear is no reason to stop yourself from doing anything. Right now is the best time ever to pick up the phone and call that person that you're afraid to talk to a person that you don't understand their culture and you want to know more about them. This is a great time to start that business that you're unsure about. This is times of panic and disruption. These are the best times to do things that scare you. So, you know, it is just incredibly important to take risks and intellectual risks. And you don't have to believe everything that everybody tells you. I move in so many different circles and so many different types of beliefs and cultures and conversations. And, you know, it is important for me to remind myself constantly that you believe what you believe, but you always have to be open and you always have to be curious. And that at the end of the day, what are your principles and values? My main motivation in life is being empathetic and merciful to other people. It's caring for other people. And if something is even as little as being mean to a guy on the internet, Ryan Lindsay called me out in the Facebook group once because I was being a jerk to some guy who was a Democratic nonsense person or whatever, you know, talking about adding 500 people to the U.S. Senate, which is a nonsense idea, and I was dismissive of it. I was rude, and he called me out on it because I violated my own principles that I try to articulate, and he was right to do it because I was unkind, you know. So I think that's just important. So let's continue down this path because I've been kind of, you know, we're all in this moment where we're all truthers, and everybody's a truther right now, which is not uncommon. So, you know, I was listening to one of our book recommendations, Michael Shermer's lecture on Audible about conspiracy theories and why people believe conspiracy theories. Michael Shermer is the editor of Skeptic Magazine. He's been on Rogan a few times. His big thing is debunking the bunk and bad ideas. He's an atheist. He's, you know, anti-conspiracy theory, which I want to say that conspiracy theorist is a term of dismissal that I don't like, but conspiracy theories are just a bucket of terms like flat earth, that kind of stuff. So we're not trying to be rude to you. I just want to make that clear that I try not to use that pejoratively, but just as a basic neutral descriptor. But he talks about it in it, that times of natural disaster, people become very, because of the high level of stress, because of the high level of anxiety, people become more highly persuadable. And so part of the reason we're doing this show to talk about this is to get you to think about what you're reading and believing. And again, he makes a great point. Belief is easy. Skepticism and it is hard, you know. And so applying skepticism to what feels right to you is just as important as applying skepticism to what feels wrong to you or what you think may be wrong. And so it's not surprising that we're kind of in this moment. You know, as you're kind of moving through and trying to gather facts through a lot of this, there's a term falsifiable and non-falsifiable, which Tom Woods used against me. And I was like, what does this mean? I'm not smart enough to understand this. He's too smart for me. And I had to have some people explain it to me. But this brief Wired video, why you can never argue with conspiracy theorists from the Argument Clinic on Wired from 2017, is a great little brief example of how do you judge information as you're kind of working through this stuff, trying to figure stuff out. So with that, let's play this video again. You can watch it on the YouTube or Facebook if you, and I'll also put it in the show notes. So with that, here we go.
To which you will inevitably hear, you think the people who faked the moon landing couldn't gin up a couple of phony photos? Wake up, sheeple! And there's the problem. Any evidence that would seem to contradict the conspiracy is further proof of the conspiracy. It cannot be disproven. Or, to use a term from science, it is not falsifiable. A hypothesis is falsifiable if you could imagine a way to prove it wrong through observation. So let's say I've only ever seen white swans. And so I assume that all swans are white. This is a falsifiable claim, because if I were ever to see a black swan, it would be disproven. Pretty simple, really. Philosopher Karl Popper came up with the idea of falsifiability in his 1934 treatise, Logik der Forschung. He was German. He was trying to figure out why Albert Einstein's theory of relativity felt more rigorous than, say, Karl Marx's theory of history, or Sigmund Freud's theories of psychoanalysis. Marx's and Freud's followers pointed out that those theories could explain pretty much anything that ever happened. Open the newspaper and you could interpret almost every story through the lens of Marx's ideas. As for Freud, you could explain just about every action someone took as a response to their parents, or repression, or sublimation. But to Popper, this wasn't a feature of these theories, but a bug. These theories had explanatory power, but no predictive power. Einstein, on the other hand, made specific predictions about, for instance, how light traveled. Predictions that, if disproven, would invalidate his entire theory. Popper said that's what separated science from pseudoscience. As he wrote, every good scientific theory is a prohibition. It forbids certain things to happen. And the more a theory forbids, the better it is. It sounds strange, but good scientists and technologists actually spend a lot of time trying to disprove their theories, not prove them. Astro Teller, who runs X, Alphabet's fanciful moonshot division that builds self-driving cars and Wi-Fi delivering hot air balloons, says he rewards engineers who prove that ideas won't work.
That's it. That's the secret. Run at all the hardest parts of the problem first. Get excited and cheer. Hey, how are we going to kill our project today?
Maybe you've spotted the sticky part here. The logical endpoint of falsifiability is that nobody can ever completely prove anything. You can never know if someone won't someday discover something that invalidates everything you thought was true. Like if you're Isaac Newton, who totally locked down the laws of physics until quantum mechanics showed he was mostly wrong. But that doesn't mean what the cousin you muted on Facebook thinks it means. Calling evolution just a theory doesn't mean it's wrong or a guess. A theory has a structure that allows for dispositive evidence. It could potentially be proven wrong someday if new evidence refutes it. So far, evolution has withstood every challenge, which has only made the theory more powerful. Falsifiability doesn't weaken the theory of evolution. It strengthens it. And the opposite is also true. If a theory is not falsifiable, it's not worth debating. So remember that the next time your cousin wants to argue that lizard aliens beneath the White House run international banking. That's probably just the chemtrails talking.
All right, thoughts, Reinhold?
No, that's a real good example of scientific theory, of a lot of the rules that have to be in place and rigors that have to be in place for scientific advancement and processes that we've made over the past 100, 200 years come from. And it's put in a good way that I think people can understand it. So
yeah, so something like COVID-19 is just the same as the flu. That assertion can be disproven through the scientific theory. It can be disproven through the what's called the R-naught value, the spreadability of it. It can be disproven in multiple different ways. And even though the numbers look the same of 60,000 here and 60,000 here, that doesn't mean that they're the same. That one fact is being used to ignore a bunch of other facts. And it's being ignored as a premise to reopen the economy, right? Well, you don't have to ignore facts to reopen the economy. Just make a better argument that is more true or that is more common sense, because it's out there. You don't need to try and pigeonhole us into like basically just dumb arguments. Like there is just, I'm sorry, if you think that it's the flu, there's plenty of scientific information to show that this is distinctly different from the flu and more dangerous. But the reality is that life is about risks. And so we know we have to discover the facts about how this affects the population and individual segments of the population and individual people as best as possible. And then,
as you mentioned before, the data changes as we learn more about it.
Exactly.
And people are taking that, oh, you said this before, now you're saying this. We can't listen to anything you say. You're not credible.
Right.
It's like, that's not how it works.
No. And so as people learn more information and you give them more proper, true information, people then can then do risk assessment for their own lives, right? Like, so the local Chick-fil-A brought in the IU pathogens unit to design a system to keep their employees and their workers safe. They did risk assessment and they said, I need to do X, Y, and Z because I don't want there to be consequences to bad behavior, right? And, you know, Reinhold's calculations as a person who, you know, has a myriad of people in his life with health complications and are more vulnerable is going to have a different risk assessment than I'm going to have, right? We make risk assessments every day. It's why you stop at the stop sign. You don't stop at the stop sign because the government tells you to stop at the stop sign. You stop at the stop sign out of rational self-interest. If I run that stop sign, if I go through this crossroads, I may kill myself or somebody else, and I can't live with that. Most people don't murder because their own personal ethics don't want them to murder, right? So we drive cars, which are incredibly deadly, and that is a risk assessment. But you don't drive your car 120 miles an hour. You drive it 55 because of risk assessment. With your seatbelt on, right? Like, yeah. Maybe the government influenced people to put their seatbelts on out of mandatory behavior, but most smart, rational people were going to wear their seatbelt once they learned the information that people like Ralph Nader brought to the population. Once people learned about the dangers of smoking, they quit. And they did that through science. So we don't have to push bullshit numbers to get people to do what needs to be done and make the arguments that we need to make or overstate the case of COVID-19 because we want everybody to stay in our house. You know, I'm scared for my mom too, and I know that a lot of you have people that you love that are on the front lines. But that doesn't mean that we need to keep everybody in their house for 2 years to keep my mom alive. My mom doesn't want that. My mom wants face masks. My mom wants people to be responsible and to live their lives responsible. I think that is what's driving me crazy too, is that we're kind of comparing things that don't make a lot of sense, and it's getting a little crazy. The final little quick video is from neuroscientist. Her name is Shannon O'Dell, and she talks about how do conspiracy theories, how do they work in the brain? What type of person, because there is a person that is more likely to believe in conspiracy theories than other based on brain chemistry, believe it or not. And so your uncle who, you know, is listening to Alex Jones, who believes in a flat earth, may have a different brain structure than we do. And so this is a video on the Inverse channel. Again, I'll put these all in the show notes from 2019. And neuroscientist Shannon O'Dell breaks down what happens in the brain to brain chemistry. So let me share that screen over there. This is kind of neat. I like this ability.
The human brain is wired to see patterns to help us survive. Dark clouds mean a storm is coming. A mysterious shadow means a predator is trying to murder you, that sort of thing. Sensing patterns can save your life. Pattern processing became increasingly sophisticated with expansion of the cerebral cortex, particularly the prefrontal cortex and regions involved in image processing. As we evolved, the brain got so good at finding patterns that it sometimes sees a pattern in completely unconnected data. Enter the conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theories generally refer to explaining important events as secret plots by powerful groups. People who believe in conspiracy theories have brains that are more prone to illusory pattern perception, aka finding connections when there are none. In one study, researchers flipped coins and asked subjects to record the results. People who thought they saw patterns in the random coin flips were more likely to believe in at least one major conspiracy theory. So why do conspiracy theorists sometimes see connections that just aren't there? Neuroscientists believe it may be due to extra dopamine in their brains. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter involved in emotion, reward, and cognition. It's thought to be especially important in decision-making, as it helps people find signal in noise. People with genetically higher levels of free dopamine are more likely to believe in one or more conspiracy theories. In fact, in an experiment where a drug to increase dopamine levels was administered to non-believers, they behaved more like believers, seeing patterns in random shapes. But it just doesn't add up. Egyptian alien gods, flat earth, Illuminati, lizard men, How can conspiracy theorists keep on believing these improbable ideas without coming to terms with the literal mountains of evidence? Unless, that's it. Confirmation bias. Once the brain sees a pattern, information which supports it is easily assimilated to the brain and acts to reinforce belief in that pattern. The brain pays attention to information simply because it agrees with the current belief, while disregarding anything to the contrary. Ironically, the explosion of information on the internet may have made the problem worse, not better. Conspiracy theorists can now accumulate lots and lots of misinformation, creating communities and echo chambers, which only act to reinforce their conspiracy beliefs. And that brings us to fear of the unknown. The amygdala and the insula are the drama queens of the brain, and they will raise the alarm in uncertain situations. Feelings of powerlessness can compel a person to try to find order in chaos, and that often means finding patterns where there are none. Studies show that people will gravitate towards conspiracy theories if they feel as if they have no power in their own lives. And although it may seem fun to think we live on a flat disk controlled by NASA, disregarding science and facts can be extremely dangerous. And while you can't force someone to stop believing in a conspiracy, research suggests that there may be a way to turn these people around. Empowering people by encouraging them to take action in their own personal lives can reduce feelings of helplessness, and in turn, reduce their reliance on conspiracy theories. And luckily, you don't have to return your hat when you stop believing, which is a good thing, because it's a pretty incredible fashion choice. All right?
So, the fear of the unknown is something that I think is really affecting people right now. It's affecting me. It's like, you know, I hate being uncomfortable. I hate not knowing the future. I hate uncertainty. I like things to be predictable. I like things to be ordered. It's just like, I hate that we don't know what the economy is going to be like right now. I don't know what's going to happen with my job. I don't know if my clients are going to come back when we reopen. If I can get you to reopen the economy, then maybe things will go back to the control that I had in January. If I can keep you inside, then maybe I can keep my husband alive. You know, it's because we feel out of control and we feel uncertain, we have that fear of the unknown, we have to try and figure it out and get some control by either controlling other people or by looking at patterns that kind of confirm our bias to make us feel better. You literally have grooves in your brain. So what happens is, it's why breakups are literally as painful as withdrawal from opioids. Because when you see somebody, it releases the oxytocin and the serotonin in your brain, and you just see their face. You know, when I see their face, I light up and I'm happy and I love them. And then when you break up, all of a sudden that groove, that pattern of is torn apart, and that ridge that was created and the neural connectors is starting to separate and it has to break down, and it's literally painful. If you go through a breakup, it's literally physically painful because of the changes that are happening in your brain, the withdrawal from oxytocin, the withdrawal from serotonin. It's painful physically. And so that's because those patterns have created grooves in your mind. And so the more you start looking down these rabbit holes, the more you start to see, well, this is connected and that's connected. And so if your automatic pattern is to instinctually say that this group is doing it, or the government is doing it, or they're doing it, then you're more biased. Libertarians are more biased to falling into conspiracies that the CDC has taken half their deaths off their website under the cloak of the night or the dark of the night, because you're just more likely to believe that the government would do that, because you spend all day, every day, researching information that confirms your bias that the government is corrupt and evil. I'm not going to say they're not, but the reality is you have to step back and go, all right, this doesn't seem right. Like 65,000 deaths yesterday, 35,000 today. How does somebody get away with just disappearing 30,000? Like, You know, like there's a logical explanation for 1,700 nursing home deaths being added in New York because they tested those people after they died. And they're adding those numbers. That's why that 35,000 number exists. It's not so.
It's something that I noticed is that whenever I hear something that seems too good to be true or too special, like we argue on, as libertarians, we argue against the government interactions and things. And then you hear something that just confirms that by you. You're like, oh, this is perfect. This will really show the other side. And then you don't take the time to go and look at it. And a lot of times when I go and look at those, they don't turn out to be what we thought they were. There's something else underlying. It's not that good of a story. And some people will just run with it and believe it for the rest of their lives. And other people will look at that and go, okay, maybe this was a little far-fetched.
Yeah.
But it's so enticing that when you get that perfect piece of news and you're like, this is it. This is really going to switch things up.
I'm going to fucking own the libs. I'm going to get those damn Republicans with it. Yeah, listen, nobody, it's pride. Like, the social media is a pride machine. It's all about just reinforcing your own vanity. This is a very unhealthy system that encourages fights. So it will give attention and lift to the ones that have the most comments. So it encourages content makers like me to tweak you and get you mad and to shitpost so you'll comment more. So more people will see my stuff and I'll be rewarded with more Patreon members. Like, it's a fucked up system.
Works.
It works so well. And you always have to remember that if you're inside social media, if you're watching this, and I know this is ironic because there's 38 of you watching right now, you're in a dopamine box. Did you hear the woman talking about dopamine? You're in a dopamine box that is just encouraging. Just push that little button one more time, rat. Just do it one more time. You know you want that another hit. That's what these are designed to do. And so it gives you information as much as they will go before Congress. And we have fact checkers like Snopes. Their entire business model is getting you to get pissed off. And so if you're not feeling well, then maybe you should re-examine where you get your information. Because I'll tell you, when I go offline and I stop reading social media, and that's because there are times where that's the bulk of my information gathering is just logging on Facebook and Twitter and seeing what people are saying. I don't feel as good as when I go read, I have all kinds of different sites that I go here and look at and my bookmarks and, you know,
I do with social media is I'll take that information that you're getting, or getting like people start talking about this subject. And that's when I take that as a cue to go, okay, I'm going to go look somewhere and find out about this. I'm not going to just take what these people are saying at face value, because you're just getting all kinds of stuff, right? You can't do that. You have to go look up the sources. So, you know, like when somebody says this CDC report, well, I go look at it and see what it says. I don't just take what their word for it is.
Yeah. So, it is. I want to play something before we end, because, you know, I saw it this morning and it's such a good little reminder. It's called The Great Realization by Tom Foolery. And I think what we need to, part of what I want to do here is to get you to be more independent minded, to get you to basically what I want to do with We Are Libertarians is talk to you and teach you how I think and try to think about these things and tell you that I'm not the greatest thinker in the world, but to give you resources to maybe go out and figure things out on your own and create a community of people who are independent minded and willing to stand up and say, I'm not going to agree with you. I have to disagree with you here, and do it respectfully and do it in a way that is helpful, you know, because there's so much trash out there. And I'm not going to say that we're a perfect organization, because we are not. Our Instagram is just full of shit posting memes, and our Facebook too, to try and make you laugh. But a lot of that is to try and make you think too. But I just want, you know, I want you to be better prepared, because when you're prepared, you feel less anxiety. You feel more secure when you read books, when you go out and try to understand things you don't understand, and you just feel better about your life. You feel more in control. And using this time where everybody feels a little anxious, to try and decrease some of that anxiety for you and to show some of these cognitive biases and just go, hey, just like take a step back and think about what you share. And I do this all the time. Like I took something down the other day. There was this great picture of the governor not abiding by his own laws and rules. And I shared it. And a couple of Republicans dinged me in the comments and said, do you have a date on that? Did that actually happen? And I looked and I was like, you know what? There is no date on it. I have no idea if that actually happened. And while I'm all about making fun of the government, you know, I'm not willing to lie and push the truth. So if this is not the truth, that if this didn't happen yesterday, I'm not going to share it. And a lot of people messaged me like, hey, did you take that down? I wanted to share it with my friend, right? Well, it turned out to be true, so I reshared it because it's hilarious. But what you share, what you amplify matters a lot. And so that's why I always ask you to amplify this show. Share it with people. If you really like this show, hit the share button. If you get something out of an episode, share it with your friends. That's the only way that we're going to grow. If conspiracy theories like the flat earth can spread on word of mouth, why can't we are libertarians, people? But, you know, it's also about getting you to think like, hey, before I share that article that feels right, let me just do a little double checking on this. And I had really started to take this responsibility of what I contribute to society and my own echo chambers and to my friends was the Covington kids thing. Because when, I was like, look at this outrageous thing that happened. This is effing BS. These kids are trash. And then like the multiple angles came out and like I was just embarrassed for my own behavior, trashing these kids who were just like minding their own business, and some liberal activists like made them look foolish. They got what they wanted. They, you know, and there are still people listening to me say that going, he got that story wrong. Those kids were doing this. And it's like, they just can't let it go. Like that anchor bias, that first piece of information, they cannot let go of it. They can't just go, I was wrong. And he just said, at some point you got to lay down your pride about stuff. There are facts that are different now than there were in March about the coronavirus pandemic. There are things that we believed and said on Facebook as me and as listeners and you and everybody that we believed back then that may not be true now. And there's no shame in going, I got it wrong back then. Or I didn't know I could, you know, like it, we were all told the same information, right? We were all told we need, holy shit, look at the field hospitals we got to put up in New York City. Like, better to be prepared. So it wasn't a mistake, but we all thought, man, it's going to be tragic. They're going to fill these hospitals. That didn't happen, right? So there's no point in arguing that this was, you know, a giant 1918 pandemic flu. You know, so you at some point have to go, hey, I was probably wrong about that thing. And, you know, you don't even have to say it out loud. Just stop sharing bullshit that to try and prove yourself right, because that's what people judge you on. Go ahead.
Play there too, because we've got people that argue, well, the reason why we didn't have that big of a rush is because we did flatten the curve and all those actions we took actually worked. You can't prove that.
Right.
Right. It may be the case. It may not be the case. You so that's where that falsifiability comes in.
Yeah, you just like you can't prove that we didn't flatten the curve, that it had no effect. Yeah. It's as Tom Woods said about this particular thing to me, it's an unfalsifiable claim. You cannot prove whether or not the shutdown worked or not and having everybody stay in their homes, because Bob Evans was full on Easter. The traffic yesterday was like rush hour. Like, people are not sheltering in place like the government is saying that they're sheltering in place. So let's all stop being drama queens. But what I did like, and what I think we need to do, is to think about what kind of world we want to build as we move forward. Because I can tell you that while I really enjoy my life and I enjoy the life that I had, it was very busy. It was very productive. And there have been many moments over the last few months or the last couple months where I've thought, I was working so hard for what? For this, to sit here and have this dinner with this person, to have this moment with that person. And so that life that I had, like, I'm not rushing back to the life that I had in January. You know, and I know that that there are people who lost a lot of income and that they're really scared and they're in a different situation than me. And I don't say that to demean your situation, you know, or people who have lost a loved one in all of this. But there have been moments where I've thought, I'm going to take it a lot slower from here on out. I don't need to have, Reinhold, I literally had every moment of my day scheduled. I mean, it was just every moment, you know. I mean, it was just constant. And for what?
Take it easier. You're going to take it easier, but how much content have you been pumping out?
Yeah. Well, part of that is working from home and just having, you know, it's like I got my stuff done and there's not as much, you know, conversation in my life.
But and part of that, too, is once you stop pushing so hard, things come a little bit easier.
Yeah.
You'll notice that, right? So maybe it's. I'm able to get my thoughts together clearer and put this together when I'm not focused on I have to do this and I got this to do and I got that to do and I got this list of things and you're constantly beating yourself up for not getting all of your things done and yeah. you feel like you're going a mile a minute and you're never accomplishing anything. If you take a break, calm down, quit hating yourself, start thinking about things a little bit better.
That time pressure.
You end up achieving more.
Yeah, that time pressure. You know, how many dinners did I miss out on the people that I love because I had to go do that thing that isn't as important to me as...
That you didn't want to do anyway, right? You just felt like you had to.
Yeah. So, you know, no is going to be a bigger part of my vocabulary, as well as no to my own eating habits and no to my overspending. You know, like times of crisis expose your own weaknesses and you go... I need to be better prepared because if I did lose my job, I would have been in trouble. But from here on out, I'm not going to be in trouble next time, you know, because the government can only give me $1,200 and I'm not getting it till tomorrow. They're a month behind. So, you know,
what you realize when you have that preparation, when you have that 3 months, 6 months, you know, that you have saved up that you could survive for that long, then you get the screw you money.
Right.
And you find that your job becomes a lot more bearable because you know that you can walk out on it at any time.
Yes, Jerry, I know I didn't miss too many dinners, you smart aleck. And that's the point, is that I'm possibly one of the vulnerable because, you know, I was losing weight. Like, I've lost 70 pounds, but I could work harder. Let's be honest. But let me play this thing that I just fell in love with today and shared it on everything. And I want to share it with you because it's really, really good. It's called The Great Realization, posted April 29th on Probably Tomfoolery. Again, it will be in the show notes.
Tell me the one about the virus again.
And if you're listening, it's a dad reading a bedtime story to his kids. And she says, tell me the one, and then I'll go to bed.
I'll go to bed.
But my boy, you're growing weary, sleepy thoughts about your head.
Please, that one's my favourite. I promise just once more.
Okay, snuggle down, my boy, though I know you know full well. The story starts before then, in a world I once would dwell. It was a world of waste and wonder, of poverty and plenty, back before we understood why hindsight's 2020. You see, the people came up with companies to trade across all lands, but they swelled and got much bigger than we ever could have planned. We'd always had our wants, but now it got so quick. You could have anything you dreamed of in a day, and with a click. We noticed families had stopped talking. That's not to say they never spoke, but the meaning must have melted, and the work-life balance broke. And the children's eyes grew squarer. And every toddler had a phone. They filtered out the imperfections, but amidst the noise, they felt alone. And every day the skies grew thicker, till you couldn't see the stars. So we flew in planes to find them, while down below, we filled our cars. We'd drive around all day in circles. We'd forgotten how to run. We swapped the grass for tarmac, shrunk the parks till there were none. We filled the sea with plastic, because our waste was never capped, until each day when you went fishing, you'd pull them out, already wrapped. And while we drank and smoked and gambled, our leaders taught us why. It's best to not upset the lobbies. More convenient to die. But then in 2020, a new virus came our way. The governments reacted and told us all to hide away. But while we all were hidden, amidst the fear and all the while, the people dusted off their instincts. They remembered how to smile. They started clapping to say thank you and calling up their mums. And while the car keys gathered dust, they would look forward to their runs. And with the skies less full of voyagers, the earth began to breathe, and the beaches bore new wildlife that scuttled off into the seas. Some people started dancing. Some were singing. Some were baking. We'd grown so used to bad news, but some good news was in the making. And so when we found the cure and were allowed to go outside, we all preferred the world we found to the one we'd left behind. Old habits became extinct, and they made way for the new. And every simple act of kindness was now given its due.
But why did it take a virus to bring the people back together?
Well, sometimes you've got to get sick, my boy, before you start feeling better. Now lie down and dream of tomorrow and all the things that we can do. And who knows, if you dream hard enough, maybe some of them will come true. We now call it the Great Realization. And yes, since then there have been many. But that's the story of how it started, and why hindsight's 2020.
So I thought that was beautiful. So a high school friend posted a video where there was a birthday parade. And I know at this point it's kind of cliche. And I have to, and it was her crying as people who loved her and her students drove around the corner and honked at her, trying to make her feel special. And I thought to myself, well, that's really cute. First, my first was another one of these parades. And I was like, but look at her crying because that's her feeling good. And then I thought, you know, and I don't know their relationship. Wonder if, like, last year she just got a card because they were too busy. You know, did any of those people who were in that parade give her a call? Did anybody text her? Or did she get, like, 4 texts and a card and nobody tried to make her feel special at all? So there are things that have come out of the last 2 months that suck. Like Facebook discussions, that's a minor thing. Losing graduations, and we talked about this in our first episode. There's going to be a lot of little sacrifices. There are things like giving up your college graduation or losing your business or your job or losing your family member or your friend or, you know, those bigger sacrifices that are unfair. You know, it's unfair that my mom has to face danger when she goes into work. It's unfair that my grandparents are separated. One's in memory care, the other's not. And that they, who knows when they get to touch each other next. After 60 years of marriage. That's unfair. And the unfairness, I think, leads to people getting upset. And so they turn on their neighbor. Or they start tantruming on Facebook, or they turn to bad coping mechanisms, or they turn to drugs, or they turn to all kinds of just destructive things. And there's a lot in this that's just bad, and it sucks, and it's unfair, and, you know, some of it the government created, but most of it is just what every generation in history has had to experience. We are uncomfortable because we have been immune from the experience that almost every generation in history has ever had to live through. And so I know that it's kind of like people get pissed off when you share the meme about, you know, sitting on your couch and that's tyranny or whatever. But like, we're literally in America living in a pretty good situation compared to 100 years ago or 200 years ago or 500 years ago. You know,
or now to people who are in less, you know, third world countries are having to deal, because it's going to hit them, and they're not going to be able to deal with it like this. Yeah. So it's going to be devastating to them.
So the grief is real, and people experience grief, and it's, you know, as Rachel says, we are allowed to be upset, and there are things that we should be upset about. But try to focus on the things that are good that you can control, because it's going to make this easier. It's going to make your life better. And just like that video says, like, take that stuff out of this. You know, people in the 1918, the reason that you probably never heard of the severity of the 1918 pandemic and 50 to 100 million, if 100 million people died, that means 5% of the earth died in about 24 weeks. You know how incredibly, unbelievably devastating that is? We're talking, it would be in today's number, 6 million Americans just dropping dead in 24 weeks. Go ahead.
That was the second wave, too, that took that large amount. The first wave wasn't that big.
Yeah.
It mutated and got worse.
And there were no plays, there were no movies, there were no books, because nobody wanted to remember it because they were so embarrassed with how they acted.
And one book about it, I think, is what's The Pale Rider?
Yeah, The Pale Rider.
Yeah.
And, you know, people don't want to remember, like... I guess my point is, I see like people screaming at each other. You know, I saw these two kids. This was about 2 weeks ago. I was driving somewhere, and these two 10-year-old boys had Trump hats on, and they were riding past this house in a well-to-do neighborhood, and on the front porch were a group of middle-aged women who started flipping their middle fingers at these 10-year-old children and screaming obscenities because they saw two children in Trump hats. They didn't see kids. They saw children. They saw, I don't know what they saw, but I cannot fathom the level of insanity that I had let myself sink to, where I would flip the bird and scream obscenities at two 10-year-olds. I almost stopped my car to lecture them, but I'm not a scold. And that has been the most terrifying moment for me, when people have let themselves get to that point that they will scream obscenities at children because their parents have different political beliefs. Like, let's not walk away from this being those people. Let's not walk away ashamed that we were just like, when people talk about half the deaths being in nursing homes, so everybody just needs to get back to work. Like, you have to understand that codes, that translates to me as, you don't think that old people are as worthy as you. You don't think that their lives are as valuable as yours. People with conditions. And I know you're not trying to say that, but that's how it comes across. And somebody needs to say it to you to be more empathetic. You know, we try to make your political points in empathetic ways, because we should walk out of whatever this is a little bit better in our personal lives, in our family lives, as a society, a little bit better and more together. But it's going to have to start with us kind of laying down some pride and thinking about things a little bit differently, and just individually making different choices in what we amplify and how we talk to people. You're on mute again.
I'm not. Am I on mute?
No, can you hear me? No, you're not. Yep.
Okay. No, it's definitely something that there's something to take from all of this. And I think that video is a good lesson to some of the things I've been trying to say for years about the way the economy has been going, is that it's been being propped up, and people have been told to remember after 9/11, that's when it first started, with people saying, go out and spend money to keep the economy going. That's patriotism.
Yeah.
And go spend money, go buy money, you know. So we became this culture that we didn't save. We spent. We kept the economy numbers up. We wanted good times all the time. And it's not how it works, right? It's not the way it was supposed to work. A free market economy is supposed to go up and down as needs and things adjust to how supply and demand happens. And we just became tools of the politicians telling us to go out and change our lives because this is the way it should be. And it became... it was kind of like that in the 80s, and then we got away from it. Like, there was a real big push way back then of consumerism, and then it all went away. And I don't know if it was partly because of certain things that happened, like AIDS and things like that, or just the crash of the the dot-com bubble or 9/11 did something there, but 9/11 really kind of brought it back and we started doing it again. So I'd have to kind of think about that a little bit and figure out how that worked and what the precipitators were. But I've seen it for a while now where it's like we're borrowing money at incredible rates in the government in order to keep propping up an economy that really needed to breathe for a few minutes and take a break and say, okay, let's see where we're at.
Somehow you faded out and it was epic. But you're right. It is, if you are a person who is a collapsitarian who believes that at some point we're going to have hyperinflation, the most important thing you can have in your life is good connections with the people that are in your immediate area. Right? Like that matters more than anything else. Because if the government collapses and you believe that, then preparation for yourself, your family is key. Having good relationships with people around you is key. Like the reality is Big Fish, it really hit me when I watched Big Fish, that moment where he's being carried out, that he's carrying his dad out to, and all the people from his life are there singing as he's going out to see, like, that's your life. Your life is 100 people around you. What some epidemiologist, it shouldn't matter what some governor says about your life. You should be making your own decisions. I firmly believe that, you know, we outsource knowledge. We try to understand, but the broader, the bigger part problem in some of this is that what had to be done in New York, we felt like we had to do in Montana. And that's because we've let the government and the media make our society so big that it makes us insane to try and comprehend it. And it makes us easier to control. And if you want the antidote to that, it is taking control of your own life. It is taking control of your own community by building good relationships with those around you. It's localism. That's how you fix it. And
localism, and it's
stop clicking on bullshit.
Yeah, and it's also building the institutions you say you want to exist.
Right.
If we want to have a non-governmental society where government is very small or non-existent, all those things that government thinks it should be doing and still needs to be done, it still needs to happen and needs to be done by nonprofits and non-governmental agencies, things like that, they need to exist. They need to be put in place and work before we can let them go from the government side of things. Because if we don't do that, then you're talking about just wiping away all the work and effort that needs to go into building those. Right now, let's take the advantage that these things are being done and let's build the alternatives and let's get them in place so that we can tell the government, we don't need you to do this anymore. We can do this better without your stupid politics bull already.
Yeah.
You know, and prove it to them, not just say we can do it. Let's do it.
All right, let's start wrapping up. Final thoughts.
I think people should really do the effort to rethink about everything that they think of. You know, always question the things that you see that are important, that you think support your thinking. And if we want to go off on a little tangent off of what the topic was, there's a big doings going on in the Libertarian Party this weekend, from last weekend, determining what to do about the National Convention. There's a lot going on. If that's something that concerns you, look into it. Talk to your representatives. Talk to your region, you know, representatives. Talk to the your LNC members. Find out what's going on. Get involved because this is important stuff that's happening, and I think everybody's voice should be heard in that.
No, we did not get to Justin Amash. I'm sorry. We just got on a roll and I had a lot prepared.
You're close.
Yeah, so we're not, and I don't have the time or energy to get to it. So we'll do it in another show. There was a great debate that, well, I don't know how much we need to say because Brian Ellison and Brian Nichols did a great job on that. So listen to the last episode. But all right, thank you so much for joining us here on We Are Libertarians. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something out of this, again, please share it. Even if you didn't agree, take the spirit of the show and say, hey, here's a different perspective. These guys are trying to do something different. We're truly trying to put people before parties, people before politics, and trying to do political talk in a different way that is hopefully unlike anything else you hear in a positive way, that connects with people of every stripe, you know. So we are libertarians. We do care about people, and that's the fundamental right. But we try not to insult you and try to get you to think. And if you don't agree, you don't agree. That's okay. At least you listened. At least you paid attention. To be heard is incredibly important. To be heard is a fundamental piece of human dignity. And that is a part of it. So go find somebody in your life and just sit down and listen, because they'll love it. So that is my final thought. Thank you for joining us here on the show. Thank you for everyone that watched. Thank you for everyone that commented. Thank you for everyone that listened. We truly appreciate it. And thank you to our patrons. We could not do this without our patrons. We could not do this without people supporting us. We do a different show, and that does not fit with advertisers. And our patrons are the ones that keep us afloat. And we thank you so much for that. So, and thank you to Dashing Media, by the way. You know, Dashing Media in this time, she is, my friend Lex is a great person who is out there helping companies, and she sponsored this episode. You heard the commercial at the very beginning. You know, I will be honest, things are tough for her like they're tough for everybody. So if you've got some marketing needs that you want, please go thank her for stepping up and sponsoring on the show, because she said, I know you have a really, like, hardcore audience. She's a person who is, I don't think she's a libertarian, but she watches our stuff. She connects with us. She likes our memes. And she just said, you know, I want to get my name out there, and you have a really cool audience, and I like them. And so please go talk with her if you have some marketing needs, and support Lex through all this, and thank her for stepping up and taking a chance on advertising. I mean, we haven't had an advertiser in years. I'm not an ad salesman, but so please go hit up Dashing Media Management, and we thank Lex for sponsoring the show. All right, thank you so much, guys. We will see you again next week.